It's the middle of August, so much of the world is on holiday. European leaders are taking their typical one-month-long vacation. And of course, with all the journalists on holiday too, now is the perfect time to release pieces of bad news, as we saw in Germany this week. Israel's war in Gaza, of course, cannot take a break, and nor does America's election campaign. We'll find out about all of this and more on today's Trumpet World. Honestly, as a non-American, the US election campaign is pretty exhausting. It starts way too soon, it feels like it goes on forever, but this campaign is really important. So this week has been the Democratic National Convention. I'm joined now by Andrew Miller. Andrew, imagine I've not seen anything of the Democratic National Convention this week. What do I need to know about it?
So what the DNC is, this is the Democratic National Convention, its primary purpose is to give Harris a public platform to accept the nomination. Now, that's not huge news that she accepted the nomination because she was nominated a couple weeks ago. Everyone knew she was going to accept the nomination. This is just kind of like the public coming out that she is now officially the Democratic Party's candidate and one of the two people who could be the next president of the United States, her and Donald Trump. But the DNC is also a bit of a campaign rally. It's trying to like rally the base. So we heard from former US President Bill Clinton, gave a keynote address where he compared Joe Biden to George Washington, of all people, for stepping down for the good of the country. We heard from Senator Bernie Sanders, who's one of the most overtly socialist senators in the United States, saying that he's really hoping the Harris-Waltz administration will, one, be elected and take America in a much more socialist direction. And we heard from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who represents the most progressive wing of the Democratic Party, about how the war in Gaza needs to stop and that Israel was at fault from it in the first place. So just those highlights really show anyone around the world who's interested in what direction the Democratic Party wants to take America is they want to take America in a very overtly socialist, anti-Israel direction. Now, with all that said, I actually think the most important speech we heard at the DNC was actually not from former U.S. President Bill Clinton, but from former U.S. President Barack Obama. Both him and his wife, Michelle Obama, gave keynote addresses at this speech, and which really highlighted just how much America has changed in the past 20 years. It's really easy for Americans, and probably even more so from people from other nations watching American news, to kind of get the standpoint that like, oh yeah, 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 America always has this just really drawn out election cycle, and it gets way too much news coverage, and the coverage of it can be exhausting. Well, I remember back when Barack Obama first burst on to the scene in America. It was actually about 20 years ago where he gave another address at another DNC convention back in 2004. And if you can remember back that far, it shows that America is really a completely different nation between 2004 and today. In 2004, I've got a quote here where Obama, he's really just imbued with this like hope-filled rhetoric, the soaring hope-filled rhetoric where he talked about how Americans need to be united and that there's actually more that unites Americans that then divides them. He had the quote, "We worship an awesome God in the blue states and we don't like federal agents poking around our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states and we have gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq, and there are patriots who support it. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the stars and stripes, all of us defending the United States of America." And a lot of Americans got caught up in that hope-filled rhetoric. Even my conservative grandfather, who's like evangelical Christian and very Republican by all means, like back in those days, he's like, well, he's like, I don't normally support people like Obama, but he's like, maybe he is what America needs just to like heal the divisions in this country. And I was kind of shocked when I heard him say that. But if you listen to Obama and his wife's speech from this DNC, he's striking a very different tone. And we can actually play a clip here from Barack Obama himself about how divided he thinks America is. Okay, so you basically heard in that clip right there that he's admitting that he's not saying that there's more that unites us than divides us anymore. He's saying that America is a very divided nation. He's calling out Donald Trump by name as the problem. In the past, sometimes he'd use innuendo and say, well, the Republican candidate or something like that. He's not talking about like, well, there's people in conservative states that have homosexual friends. So it's like there's more that unites us than divides us. He's like, no, this is going to be a knockout, long drag out fight in this election. And his wife's speech, Michelle Obama, was even more divisive. Again, she called out Donald Trump by name. She explicitly accused Trump of being a racist. She focused in on comments that Trump made recently about how all these millions of illegal immigrants pouring across the border, most of them aren't very educated. So he's like, said they're taking jobs from poorer Americans who need them. He said they're taking jobs even from Black Americans who need them. And so he used the phrase Black jobs, not to be down on not being racist or anything like that, but just saying that like, there are Americans who are unemployed and need work. And if you let 8 million illegals into the country, you're not helping the Americans who need help. And so Michelle Obama focused in on that. And she said, well, she's like, in my opinion, I think that the job of U.S. president is one of those quote unquote Black jobs that Donald Trump is talking about, being that Harris is half Black, half Indian. So like Obama was half Black, half white. And so Michelle Obama said, she's really coming out in the fact that she's like, Trump's a racist. And like, we need to give the presidency to the Black candidate, basically just because of the skin color. Forget about the pot. Like if you support Israel and you don't like socialism, well, then you shouldn't vote for the candidate who hates Israel and likes socialism. You should vote for the other one. But they're trying to really make the case that like anyone who does that is a legitimate bigot or a legitimate racist, which is definitely not the type of rhetoric that you're saying that like, okay, well, there's more than unites us than divides us. That is like you're advocating for riots. You're advocating for race war. You're advocating to like get all these illegal immigrants who've come up here to like sit here and fight for this new socialist vision of America. And of course, one of the better articles I've read on this topic, it was titled Obama's DNC speech has a hidden message. And I don't think that article quite hit the nail on the head as to what the hidden message was, but there definitely was a hidden message to it. Cause it sounds like the way Obama's talking about fighting, he's talking about like, lawfare and voting and but then the way his wife talks about racism and illegal immigrants and supporting them, it's like if you're saying that if you want to defend America's border makes you racist, you are using your rhetoric to stir up a condition that could actually make a literal fight in America, like a literal like rioting or warfare in America.
I think that's a really powerful contrast. And to me, those are the two big takeaways from what we saw was the divisive rhetoric. And then I think the Democrats, the media at least, they were making a big deal about joy being a key theme of this election campaign. And I think that made this, you know, that's everyone's meant to be emphasizing joy. And then Barack Obama comes out and says, you need to fight. It made that kind of cut across even more. But then also the other big news, I think, that we've got this week from the United States, going on to even last Friday after this program aired, is how extreme the Kamala Harris program is. Because she had her speech where she outlined her economic policy, and she talked about how they want to have new laws and restrictions against price gouging. There is no evidence price gouging is happening in the food market, but grocery prices are high. People are struggling to afford food. They don't want to look at what they've done to cause it. And so they say, well, we want to have laws against price gouging, which is just it's a slippery slope from there. You can't raise the price of cheese and chicken and milk. But if the government keeps causing inflation, and then you've got price caps, now you've got price controls, and you're starting to introduce, price controls on food, that's a very socialist policy. And it's one quickly you start having stores going out of business or moving out of poor areas. Before long, you have people saying, well, maybe the government should step in and start providing food to poor areas. You had that. And then you have Bernie Sanders. If you're trying to run this centralist Unite the Nation campaign, Bernie Sanders is the last guy I'd come coming out and endorsing me and talking about what a wonderful job I've done for the last 4 years. He's someone who's not afraid to call himself a socialist and, out and out on that. So I think we also saw how radical the vision that Barack Obama is wanting the left to fight for. And of course, it's something they're going to have to fight for, because it's such a radical vision. It's not something that a lot of the country is going to embrace naturally.
Right. Yeah. Bernie Sanders is actually one of the more honest people in the Democratic Party, because he openly admits to being a socialist. Whereas looking at the voting record, we've got voting record data, because Harris spent time in the Senate and Obama spent time in the Senate. And so looking at their Senate voting records, like, both Harris and Obama are just as radical as Bernie Sanders, if not maybe more so. I think there were certain years where both Obama and Harris actually scored to the left of Sanders in the Senate. But they're a little bit more savvy politicians than Sanders is that they know that the majority of Americans don't like the word socialism. It has bad connotations from the Cold War. So they avoid using the term. But that's your analysis is absolutely right. I've got a copy of Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics on my desk right now, actually. And it points out there's two types of inflation: non-monetary inflation that happens when the price of food actually goes up, and then monetary inflation, where the price of food doesn't goes up, it just feels like it because your currency is worth less. That's definitely what we're experiencing mainly right now. There's not a ton of droughts and stuff, wars and stuff like that are affecting the price of food too much in America. So the price of food and groceries isn't going up. It's just that they've printed so much money that the money is worth less, and people are mad about it. Immigration and inflation are the two issues that Americans are probably the most mad about right now. And so Harris definitely has an incentive to try to say, it's price gouging. And what you can see is, if you look in the background of some of these people, Barack Obama was mentored by Frank Marshall Davis, who was actually a card-carrying Communist Party member, had a serial number and everything back in the 70s. And then Harris, her mother's from India, but her father's from Jamaica, and who's definitely involved in the Communist Party down there in Jamaica. So both Harris and Obama have strong connections to people who aren't just socialist, but were raised by people who were actually capital C communist. And so when they start talking about price gouging and socialism and race problems, it's like, these are terms that they grew up with from the time they were children. Heard either their actual parent or their political mentor talking about these communist principles. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Job, for you, actually has a reprint article titled Communism in America Today. And it's got a drawing of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Nancy Pelosi, and Barack Obama on the cover of it, just highlighting them as four of the most communist politicians in America. But it does go through statements Mr. Armstrong made back during the Cold War, our founder, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, saying that like the devil basically had a 1-2 punch plan to destroy the United States, where he used communism to weaken the United States to the point where it's actually vulnerable to military invasion. But then clarified that Bible prophecy says that it will be a revived Holy Roman Empire that actually invades. So it won't be a communist party like China or Cuba or North Korea that is prophesied to hit the knockout blow to the United States. But it is definitely a communist power that weakens the United States to the point where that could happen.
And this is something that is of international concern. I think there can be a tendency for non-Americans, myself included, I guess, to look at America and kind of be like, well, they're a bit obsessed with communism. Like, they kind of go a bit crazy when it comes to calling everybody a communist and being very suspicious of everything. I think there's a lot of people, particularly in the left in Britain and then in Europe, that feel kind of, you know, well, we've got a more balanced way. We've got our socialized medicine. America is way too extreme in rejecting that. And, you know, setting aside debates about socialized medicine, really the kind of free markets versus communism does just get down to freedom. And it gets down to, is the government going to tell you what job you hold, tell you when you have to work, what options you have to buy, like what range of options you can choose to buy from? It's all about limiting freedom. And then once you have a big government like that, that has the power to be involved in all of these different aspects in its citizens' lives, they're going to take advantage of that. That government is going to become tyrannical. And for the last 50, 60 more years, America has been in general a champion of freedom in the world, that it faced down the communist menace in the form of the Soviet Union. And this is something Eastern Europe really understands. They've lived under communism. They do not want to go back. And they know that America played a massive role in themselves being free from communism. And Britain too, and Margaret Thatcher, and she had a lot to do with that as well. But they know that freedom is valuable. To have America, that is just this incredibly powerful nation at the moment, step back from being a champion for freedom and have governments that increasingly embrace communism, that's going to impact freedom all around the world. It's happening because fundamentally America has abused the freedom that it's had, and it has used that freedom to get into all kinds of immorality that has sapped the national strength and the national will. But America resorting to that's not just an American domestic concern. That is going to affect everyone. And I think one way that we see this is something that's a little bit unrelated, but also the extremism that was on display to the at the DNC. And that was these pro-Hamas protests outside. And they were pro-Hamas. They were not just anti-Netanyahu. They were not anti-the Israeli army. They were out-and-out pro-Hamas. More recently, they were burning American flags, even alongside the Israeli flag. And you had Joe Biden up there, and he said they had a point.
Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides.
Really stood out to me because he said he got into the race of becoming president, that he ran for president in 2020 because of, you know, what we now know as the Very Fine People hoax. This idea that Donald Trump said in this debate between neo-Nazis and non-neo-Nazis, there are very fine people on both sides. He didn't say that. He said in the debate over General Lee's statue, there are very fine people on both sides, and specifically excluded the neo-Nazis from the very fine people. But this kind of both sides, very fine people, Joe Biden talked about that all the time. And then there he is behind the podium saying, well, yeah, the Nazis, who are the real neo-Nazis today? It's Hamas that is out there killing Jews. He is there saying, well, yeah, they've got a point. So to see Joe Biden, the US president, embracing or saying, yeah, well, the pro-Hamas people have a point. You mentioned AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Like, that's an extreme anti-freedom, anti-Western, anti-human, really, foreign policy that you're seeing some rhetorical support coming from at the Democratic National Convention.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her closest supporters have been very vocal in calling Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu actually a war criminal. So they are very pro-Hamas. And the better commentators on this are cautioning people that said, don't say pro-Palestinian when you mean pro-Hamas. So it said most Palestinians who actually live in Israeli-controlled territory want to continue living in Israeli-controlled territory. It's only the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza that want either a two-state solution or a one-state solution where Hamas is in control. So Hamas isn't representative of the Palestinians as a whole. And that is what the Democratic Party is aligning itself with, which is extremely dangerous, not just for the Palestinians being victimized by Hamas and the Jews in the Middle East, but even for the American people here. We were talking about communism and Pete Buttigieg, who he's the transportation secretary. He also spoke at the Democratic National Convention. His father, another communist, another capital C communist, wrote his thesis on Antonio Gramsci, who was a communist philosopher, who pointed out that people in prosperous nations don't often vote for communists. So in order to convince them to vote for communists, you kind of have to elicit a crisis, which oftentimes involves race riots and other types of riots. And so these pro-Hamas demonstrations at the universities that are causing violence and destroying property is creating a crisis that a number of very intelligent Marxist philosophers for decades have written that those type of crisis will cause the general population to be more likely to accept communism as a solution. And when you look at the DNC through this lens, things get a lot scarier because even with like the border crisis, 8 million people cross the border in just less than 4 years. And they're saying, well, it's a humanitarian crisis that we need to help these people. But some of them are Hezbollah agents. Some of them are drug cartel agents who would fight in a riot against President Trump if the opportunity arose, who have fought in riots, Not My President riots in 2016, George Floyd riots in 2020. Pro-Hamas riots this year. And this is the type of rioting and violence that those who are actually capital C communist advocate in order to create a crisis to transform a nation. And so if you say that, like when they've studied this topic that deeply, that these people would never use a race, deliberately stir up a riot for political ends, that does not sound logic. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's these people, they've either voted for parties that advocate for that, like John Brennan, or were raised by people who were.
That is some sobering background to when you look at the education and where these people are coming from. But the Bible has some prophecies that are dramatically more sobering when they tell us exactly where this is leading.
Yeah, one of the scriptures I brought with me today, which is Isaiah 1, verse 7, which is about end time Israel. And if you've read our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, you'll know that the United States and Britain are descended from the ancient Israelites. And that verse talks about, your cities being burned with fire. Particularly that verse says, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land strangers devour it in your presence. It is desolate as overthrown by strangers. That's from the King James Version. Some other versions of the Bible actually translate strangers as aliens, as the two words are synonyms. But now we're actually, that's a big topic that even Michelle Obama was talking about at the DNC, saying that Trump is a racist because he doesn't want to let millions of unvetted illegal immigrants into the nation. Using the King James language, you say that she's calling Trump a racist because he doesn't want to let a bunch of strangers who we don't know anything about, or we don't know a lot about, into the nation. But there's a Bible prophecy right there that it's going to be those strangers that they just lay cities desolate. I mean, right now they're causing a lot of drug cartel crime and other things like that. But this is a property that for some reason, at some point in the near future, these violence are going to get more widespread and more violent. And just given the number of people with actual connections to capital C communists trying to import them into the country, it's not a huge logical jump to see that why those riots are going to get more spread and more violent. This is being imported in deliberately to create a crisis. And if you've read, I've cited several books now, but if you've read our book, America Under Attack, you know there are prophecies in that our editor-in-chief has highlighted in Amos 7 and 2 Kings 14 that God is going to give America a temporary reprieve through this attack by an end-time Jeroboam figure who's he's identified as Donald Trump, which means that the Trump campaign is going to make a resurgence at some point and stabilize things for a little while just to give Americans a last chance to repent before things get really bad. But just because the really bad rioting is prophesied to happen after the Trump resurgence is over doesn't mean we might not receive a little bit of a foretaste of it as he's coming back to power. Barack Obama's talking about fighting. And so if maybe if Trump wins this election in an overwhelming landslide, we might be spared some of that. But if we have anything like we saw in 2020, where it's a very close election with a bunch of unverified mail-in ballots that no one's sure whether they're legitimate or not, and you've got half the nation thinks that one candidate won and half the nation thinks that another candidate won, you're in some very dangerous territory that would probably require some Supreme Court clarification. And while all that's happening, certainly wouldn't surprise me if you saw some immigration related riots or some other type of riots.
And all of that weakens America on the international stage, paving the way for them to have less of a global influence, something that's going to affect the whole world. And you're going to see the rise of other powers that we'll talk about in some of our other sections. But before we move on to that, I believe you had a few other stories you wanted to hit quickly from this week.
But there are definitely some other concerning news in America this week. One is that the Idaho Army National Guard, which is a National Guard in a pretty conservative state in the United States, actually fired one of its infantry officers for speaking out publicly on his social media accounts against transgender surgeries for children and against pornographic books in school libraries. So a couple of issues that you'd think even the liberals would agree that you shouldn't be showing pornography in school, public school libraries and mutilating children's genitals. But it's apparently it's become so controversial now that even in a conservative state, you can be fired from the National Guard for saying those things. Also, the abortion debate in America's gotten so bad that Planned Parenthood has actually killed 25 babies at the Democratic National Convention. There were no, in order to make it more convenient for all these people attending, they just brought in vans so that people who got pregnant during the convention could go out to what basically amounts to a white van and have a Planned Parenthood person abort their pregnancy, which tells you a lot about what Planned Parenthood stands for and the type of people attending the Democratic National Convention.
And that abortion story is just such a powerful picture of the decline of the United States, where we've come so fast from kind of this idea where those on the left used to say, well, we want abortion to be safe, legal, and rare, to now to the point where people are like, you know, celebrating abortion, standing up at the Democratic National Convention, boasting about their abortions, excited about the idea of abortion. It is unhinged, and it shows how much America has, the morals and morality there has declined. Well, while America has internal problems, that's going to leave a vacuum that other countries need to fill. And I think we started to see some of that with some of our news from Europe this week, where Germany began construction. They broke ground on their new military base in Lithuania on Monday. So this was announced back in December, where they're going to have 5,000 German troops that will be deployed to cover Europe's eastern flank to deter Russia. And on the one hand, it could be easy to say, okay, 5,000 troops, what's 5,000 troops going to do against Russia? You know, I think they've got a couple of hundred thousand in Ukraine. 500 isn't all that much. But this is just about the final taboo for Germany. This is about Germany becoming a normal military country and doing the same thing that all other countries do. And since World War II, it's not had any of these overseas military bases. They sent their first 20 troops over in April to begin construction here. And now they're starting to build overseas military bases. They're going to be taking on the responsibility for defending Europe. And this is part of a process. It's part of a whole range of stories. So the next day in Japan, there was a German Vice Admiral Cake, I guess it was. He was visiting Japan. He said, "We're prepared to take on greater responsibility and have signaled to NATO our readiness to assume regional command and control in the Baltic Sea. We provide the necessary command and control structure through our regional headquarters in Rostock, which operates as our international naval command center." So they're basically saying, we want to take command of all NATO forces in the Baltic Sea. They're building a military base in Lithuania. They're wanting to take command of the naval forces in the Baltic. They're in Poland talking about wanting to take command of more Eastern European forces within NATO. And that is a critical change for Germany. And so then as the United States withdraws from the world scene, as they become more divided, preoccupied with those internal divisions, turning their sights more and more against each other rather than on the world, that leaves a vacuum. That, you know, Europe is fundamentally reliant on the United States for providing its security. They're going to have to step up. Who is the country that is doing that stepping up right now? It's Germany. And so with all of the taboos gone now already, you will see a very rapid advancement where it won't be 5,000 in the first military overseas military base. It will start to be more like 10,000 here and 10,000 there. And more importantly, German commanders commanding European-wide forces. They're leading already a NATO task force for the Baltic states. And then maybe, okay, now that Germany commands all of the naval forces in the Baltic, they already have major chunks of the Dutch armed forces are now officially part of the German army and part of the German command force. I think it's Romania and I think it was maybe the Czech Republic. They've got similar arrangements with. So as you see that American vacuum, Europe is going to be forced to step up. They're not really going to have much choice. They've got Vladimir Putin on their doorstep invading a major European country. Who has the resources to do that? Well, it's only Germany that has low debt and that is Europe's largest economy. Everyone in Europe is going to be pressuring them to step up. You're going to see them step up militarily. And as they do that, well, then you're going to see more of, well, maybe we need to compete. And you see this from France already right now, where really I think they're articulating German thoughts and they're saying things that they can say that Germany probably couldn't get away with saying, where they're saying we need to be independent with America. And even we need to compete against America. We need to be prepared to defend ourselves against America. And so where this is leading is the rise of Europe as an independent military power. And another major piece of news this week, and this is, I think, a bit of bad news that they tried to bury, that is going to help change the character of this power that we're seeing rising in Europe. So this was from the Germany's Federal Criminal Police Office, where they published that illegal immigration into the EU was at its highest level since 2016. So they counted 380,200 unauthorized border crossings into Europe's Schengen passport-free zone. Germany saw a one-third increase in illegal immigration compared to last year. I mean, the migrant crisis in 2015-2016 changed Europe, and the aftershocks to that are still reverberating around Europe. That you had all of these migrants come in and change communities and lead to massive increases in crime. I mean, you're seeing more of that. Also in the news this week, you had CCTV capturing a 54-year-old Turkish national killing somebody point blank at a crowded train station in Frankfurt. That was on Tuesday. There have been a whole range of assaults within France that have come from migrants in the first half of this month. There were some attacks that I saw, some headlines about Spain coming from this week. That's going to change the personality of Europe. It already is. It has led to the rise of these parties that would have used to have been unthinkable within a lot of European countries and within especially Germany. It's creating an appetite. You know, people are saying the liberal democracy that we have now isn't working. It's not protecting our wives. It's not protecting our children. It's not protecting our people. And absolutely, these are legitimate concerns. Absolutely, migration is causing major problems. And because the mainstream isn't talking about it, it's leading people to move towards these different fringe groups. And those fringe groups, especially in Germany, you look at the Alternative for Deutschland, they have a radically different view of World War II. They have a radically different view of what Germany's role should be in the world. And so at the same time that Germany becomes militarily powerful, Europe and Germany are undergoing a personality change. And that they're rapidly not becoming the powers that they were 10, 20 years ago, where they do consider themselves in opposition to the United States. And so this is the big biblical overview that as America weakens itself from within, foreign enemies are going to rise up from without. Not just from Europe, you know, they're competing with powers from Asia, and they're going to look at a weakened United States and they're going to say, well, we have a chance at being the top dog. We have a chance of taking over here. And so America's internal weakness is critical, and it's going to pave the way for the fall of the United States and Britain and the rise of these other powers. And that is what we've been seeing in Europe. But with the rise of this European power, it's going to have a lot to do with the Middle East. It's going to have to deal with a lot of the problems in the Middle East. It will be affected by the problems of the Middle East. The Middle East plays a major factor as well into Bible prophecy. And so we'll get some of the most important news out of the Middle East now from Mihailo Zekic.
Thank you. Probably the biggest news, which strangely enough is not really being reported in much of the Western media, is that on Wednesday, Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, declared the Hamas's Rafah Brigade vanquished by the IDF's 162nd Division. That basically means, for all intents and purposes, the Gaza war is done. I mean, there's obviously still, you'll hear stories of the IDF moving out and all of a sudden these terrorists popping up out of their tunnels and then they have to come back in again. But Rafah, that little city on the border with Egypt, that was the big prize. That was the one area of territory that Israel hasn't been able to come into and take care of. That was where all the remaining battalions were. According to Gallant, that's almost done, or it is done. And he also said on that speech that they found over 150 tunnels just between Gaza and Egypt that Israel is now either destroying or gathering evidence or etc. So this whole saga that started with October 7th and then with all these Israelis wondering we have to do something about Gaza right now, it's taking a new change of direction.
Right, it's a new chapter. Because I guess there's still hostages yet to be freed, right?
Of course.
There aren't any major Hamas military units or territorial strongholds left to take. So you're expecting continued, say, lower intensity warfare to try and find and release or pressure the release of these hostages.
Yes, there's still plenty of hostages, of course. Not people aren't even sure how many are left alive. Hamas even has admitted such, although they found the bodies of a few of them that died earlier. Yeah, Sinwar, of course, no one knows where he is. But in regards to Hamas being capable of launching another October 7th attack with military-grade hardware and trained battle units, that, for the most part, has been liquidated. Of course, that could change very quickly if Israel leaves immediately, which is why they don't want to leave everything immediately. But Gallant, for himself, has said, quote, "We look to the north now." So
that was going to be my next question. I think everyone's been talking about, once they finish dealing with Hamas, they're going to deal with Hezbollah. I mean, is that what you think is going to happen now? War with Hezbollah?
It's the Middle East. There's so many different factors. It's too hard to tell. I can't tell you that at least as the last time I checked the headlines, Hezbollah launched 50 rockets into northern Israel. I think probably Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be holding his breath until what happens when Trump gets back in.
That's actually exactly what I was wondering. Would he try and string this out and delay it? Because if he could, if Donald Trump comes back, he could potentially deal with Hezbollah with a much more sympathetic White House.
He could. Or even, like you saw with some things going on with Iran, you could even see Hezbollah backing off completely without a fight, like a dog with its tail between its legs, and basically give Israel everything it wants, unless if it gets Qasem Soleimani, so to speak, assassinated.
So is the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu going to increase now as well? Because that was kind of after October, in the initial days after October 7th, opinion polls seemed to suggest we want to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu. The biggest security failure in Israel's history happened under his watch. But we don't want that to happen yet. We want to keep him in power to deal with Hezbollah, to deal with Hamas, to deal with the situation. Now that that is largely dealt with, do you think we're going to see more pressure on him to quit? Or has that public opinion changed now? Or are people thinking, well, it's not quite over. We still want him to quit, but not yet.
Well, the biggest factor, I think, in that is what's going on in Washington, as we just talked about. And my suspicion, again, it's the Middle East. There's so many different twists and turns it could take. But with the way things have been going right now, I was going to touch on this a little later, but we've been waiting for Iran's retaliation for Ismail Haniyeh's assassination. That hasn't happened several weeks on. Even though there's been a few skirmishes. And from what most people can gather, Iran has given hints that they were hoping the Gaza ceasefire talks in Qatar were going to lead somewhere and then they could have an easy way out. And the United States has been supporting that. If you tie it into what we talked about earlier with Andrew about Donald Trump and the war mentality, what got Donald Trump elected in the first place? One of the big reasons was a bellicose North Korea and how weak the Democratic Party looked in handling all these crises. Personally, I suspect that Secretary of State Antony Blinken and some of his other decision makers have that in mind, and that the worse we make conditions and the worse we batter countries like Israel, the more we're going to make Trump look palatable. And so I suspect that they might be holding the brakes on that a little bit for that reason. There was recently a big weapons deal to Israel that they've been holding off for a long time that just got approved, even though ceasefire talks fell apart. So you could definitely see a bit of a change of tune in Washington, and I think the November elections have a lot to do with that. But again, we'll see. There's so many twists and turns that this could take.
I think that's a really interesting, I guess, side point to what we've been to. But how much of what is happening in the Middle East and Israel's fate is now tied to the U.S. election? And I think I find that fascinating because that is something Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Joe Flory has drawn attention to. And you know, one of the keynote prophecies for understanding what's happening in the United States, why we expect Donald Trump to return, and the role that we expect him to take in America is outlined in 2 Kings chapter 14. And 2 Kings chapter 14, it talks about a King Jeroboam. Amos, this book of prophecy that hasn't been fulfilled yet, also talks about a King Jeroboam. So that history in 2 Kings 14 is prophetic. But it also talks about, it brings in Judah, it brings in the Jews, the Jewish state, into this, what Jeroboam is going to do and what he did anciently. And so we have often looked to Donald Trump to restore something to Israel. And I think it's fascinating that as we run up to this election now, it looks like so much for Israel hinges on the outcome of that election. And we can put something in the show notes that will give you more that you can read on that. But I think the main thing you wanted to discuss today is then when we look at, okay, well, what's the future of Gaza itself? Now that there, if that is mostly dealt with, at least the big urban Hamas strongholds, where to for Gaza?
Exactly. This has been a question Israel has been kicking the can down the road for quite some time now. But as we've talked about on this program and on our predecessor program before, what Netanyahu has most indicated is that he wants a multinational group of mostly Arab countries, Muslim countries that have already made peace with Israel to create some sort of peacekeeping force, like we saw with NATO and Afghanistan. The IDF doesn't want to stay in Gaza long term. Nobody really wants that. That happened before, and that was one of the reasons they pulled out with all the casualties they've been getting. But the Arabs don't really want that, too. The United Arab Emirates has said, we're willing to take part in if other people will. Not many people have taken up that offer because it looks like collaborating with the enemy. But that's sort of the general direction that Israel at least wants to go, and probably the most easy one to apply for both the Israeli public opinion, for the world at large, for the Palestinians. So that would most likely be the big option for that.
So we'll be seeing some of these Arab countries coming in, potentially taking over or having an outside role in Gaza. I mean, what if we've had some specific things to say about Gaza and Bible prophecy. Do you want to outline that for us and how that scenario fits right in with that prophecy?
Of course. Well, you look at the United Arab Emirates, Jordan's another potential country. Saudi Arabia doesn't have relations, but they said they want to. Those all fit in with a particular psalm, Psalm 83, which talks about an end-time group of nations making an alliance to wipe out Israel. It's a prophecy. There's no historical record talking about this, either biblical or in secular records. And specifically, verses 6 and 7 mention which countries are going to take part. It mentions the Ishmaelites. That's the modern peninsular Arabs. Even they trace their ancestry through Muslim tradition back there. It mentions Ammon. It mentions Moab, the ancestral peoples of Jordan. And crucially, it mentions the Philistines. If you look at Bible history, one of the main Philistine cities was Gaza. That's where Samson did a lot of his escapades against the Philistines. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has pointed that you could expect the Palestinians, including those in Gaza, you could expect some of these Gulf Arabs, Jordan, and some other countries too, that he's written about extensively, to form an alliance. Verse 8 brings in Asher, Germany. We just talked about that in your segment, why we're watching Germany moving into the Middle East. That hasn't happened yet. We haven't seen too many signs yet, but like even from just a perspective on the ground, Europe looks like a much more palatable partner to start helping these Arabs out than, say, America or Israel itself. So there's an opening even with that. And as I mentioned, this is not good news for Israel. You hear a lot of people on the Israeli right especially saying that, you know, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, they're our partners in confronting Iran. They're going to help us bring peace. And according to Bible prophecy, no, they're not only not are they not going to bring peace, they're going to make things dramatically worse. They're going to form an alliance to attack Israel. And if people would like to learn more about that, I mentioned our trends section quite a bit. I think it's a really undervalued section on the Trumpet website, one-stop shop about why we watch what we do. There's an article there called Why the Trumpet Watches, an Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, that can give a bit of the overall perspective of why we're watching Gaza the way we do and what we expect in the future.
And that's going to be a critical part of the rise of Europe, the role that they play in the Middle East, really as America backs out of the Middle East. Europe, they're already moving in to a large degree, but that is just going to really accelerate. And then having access to all of those resources, all of that area, that's going to give them a lot of power. And Bible prophecy tells us that actually they're going to use that against Israel in the Middle East. They're going to use that against Britain and against America. So that is an important story to watch. It's also not the only event from Europe, from the Middle East this week. You had a couple more you were going to quickly give us in a rundown.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the predicted attack that Iran, everyone's expecting to give, hasn't happened yet, and a lot of people are wondering why. Some people suspect that there may be still a similar attack as we saw in April. But again, it looks like Iran is really getting humbled because of all this. They're obviously distracted by a lot of internal politics as well. But considering everything we just mentioned, it looks like they themselves are a bit afraid on what happens in November. Which goes to show you how much stability Trump is going to give when he gets back in there. The main story I wanted to focus on was an assassination Israel did in Lebanon. This was against Khalil Makda, who was not Hezbollah, not Iran, not Hamas, but actually belonging to Fatah. That's an organization you don't hear about too much anymore, but it's the quote-unquote more moderate Palestinian group that controls the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, he belongs there. Makda and his brother Munir were actually high-level officials in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is Fatah's military wing. You don't hear about this in too much in the media, and I mean, this is the first admission Israel's done of attacking somebody this high-ranking in Fatah since the war started, but there is a bit of a tendency for people to look at Fatah and make them out sort of like like the Palestinian Gandhi, you know, like that they're nonviolent, that they're freedom fighters, that it's like the big bad imperialists, that if they just let them have their way, we could all have peace. I'd like to play for our viewers a clip. That was on October 7th. Those figures were from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Those figures were from Fatah, and Fatah themselves put that video up on their Telegram channel. It's not like this was hidden knowledge. They participated in that worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, too. They are a terror group as well. But for most of the world, when they think of Fatah, they see this. That was Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas shaking Antony Blinken's hand, Secretary of State, a few days after the October 7th massacre. That man and those fighters belong to the same organization. They're not moderate at all. They are a terror group, and they maybe are a bit more underhanded than Hamas. Maybe you see them more dressed up in suits rather than balaclavas, but they're still committed to Israel's destruction. And even if you have a handful of people maybe at the top that value Israel's cooperation, most of their supporters don't. And our editor-in-chief has written quite a bit about this based off of one Bible prophecy in Hosea 5:13. I'll read it. Quote, "When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound," end quote. Yesenius's Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon says the root word of that word wound means the pressing together, binding up of a wound, hence used figuratively of a remedy applied to the wounds of the state. And Mr. Fleury wrote in an article we had in a February edition of this year, "The way this word is used, the remedy does not heal the wound. It is the wound." And he has pointed to this basically meaning the Palestinian peace process. And when you see the partner that we gave the West Bank over to in the Oslo Accords doing things like that, it shows you how much of a wound it is.
And I think it's also important. So they're meeting in Lebanon, the heartland of Hezbollah, that has really close links to Iran.
This guy was, according to the IDF, one of the IRGC's main point men in funneling weapons and money into the West Bank for Israeli attacks like we saw from Gaza.
Yeah, and that is absolutely critical to remember. Like, we've had war in Gaza, so it can be easy to kind of think Gaza, dangerous, West Bank safe. And that Israel has got the West Bank safe and secure, exactly as you said. Like, people look on Fatah as being the moderates. The moderates are in charge in the West Bank. We don't have to worry. And that news, you know, him visiting, meeting with these Iranian terrorists, all of that, it's a really important reminder that, no, the West Bank or Judea Samaria, it is not safe and secure and in the bag for Israel. And Iran is actively working with groups to take that back from Israel. And just because it hasn't blown up with this Gaza war doesn't mean that it's never going to. It just means that they're waiting for the right time and the right conditions. And that is so important to watch. Because just like we talked about on our Wednesday show, so much of Bible prophecy revolves around Jerusalem. And one of the key events in Jerusalem, I guess this was last Wednesday's show, but one of the key events in that countdown of Bible prophecy is half of Jerusalem falling, East Jerusalem falling. Who is that going to fall to? It's going to fall to Iranian-linked Palestinian terrorists from the West Bank. So this is going to come in and harm Israel. And that is what it's leading to. So there is that real danger there.
Of course, whether or not it's Fatah or some other group, we can't tell just yet. But again, that article, The Jewish State's Deadly Wound from February, gets a bit of the context on there on why the West Bank is important and why we can expect that to boil over soon.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Mihailo. Europe is not the only part of the world, though, that is on the rise. We're also watching for Asian powers to rise, particularly China and Russia. We've heard a lot about Russia in recent weeks and the war with Ukraine, Ukraine's incursion into Russian territory itself. This week, we're going to take a little bit more of a look at China with Jeremiah Jacques.
That's right. I wanted to talk about a big story showing that China is becoming increasingly unhinged in its drive to take over the South China Sea. So on Monday, Chinese boats rammed into two Philippine ships. And this was at a location that is well within Philippine waters. It's near a place called Sabina Shoal. This Chinese aggression punctured a 3-foot-wide hole in one of the Philippine vessels and an almost 5-foot-wide hole in the other one. And the Philippine Coast Guard says that this is the worst structural damage that they've suffered so far as a result of this kind of Chinese aggression. Now, China claims that the Philippines was to blame for this and is at fault in these collisions, but there's video evidence of it. And the video evidence clearly shows that this violence, as on previous similar occasions, was caused by China. Leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, they point to ancient maps to make these sweeping claims over almost the entire South China Sea. But international law makes clear that China's claims are unlawful and they're outrageous, really. And back in 2016, the Hague's Permanent Court of Arbitration specifically examined some of the maritime territory that's claimed by both China and the Philippines. And the court ruled that the Philippines is right and China is wrong. So China's claims here clearly violate international law, and they encroach upon the lawfully held territory of several other nations, including the Philippines. But China, of course, has zero interest in international law. They defiantly ignore international law unless it happens to suit their cause of the day. So they just keep on ramming other nations' boats, damaging their vessels, intimidating these less powerful countries. A few months back, one of these Chinese temper tantrums actually resulted in one of the Philippine crewmen having his thumb severed. You know, so just really stunning violence that we're seeing here. But so far, no one has stood up to China in a meaningful way. The United States is a treaty ally to the Philippines, but so far the US says that all this Chinese aggression falls beneath the threshold of what it would take for America to act. And so China just keeps on pushing and keeps on antagonizing. This is a country that is living the way of Git on a national level, and it's very disturbing to see them growing so unhinged and so self-righteous in all of this aggression.
It is such a textbook example. I bring this up in my international relations class because it's such a textbook example of the limitations of international law. Like, you can have this law that is really clearly drawn out, and that you have this very clear process of arbitration to settle who owns what bit of maritime territory. And then China just comes along and says, I don't care. And there is nothing that a small nation like the Philippines can really do about it, because China has more power than they do. And it showed, you know, America and Britain have worked to kind of create this, what they call now the rules-based international order, and a global kind of sense of rule of law and things like that. And I think this story exposes the reality of that, that that doesn't really exist. And when they can get away with it, nations are just going to do what they want, do what's in their own interest, rather than taking this very egalitarian long-term view that we're all better off if everybody sticks to international law. And so this is an example of where a nation can get away with breaking the law. They're going to do it. And it tells us a lot about China's character and really what the post-American world looks like. A lot of people can be very critical of American foreign policy. You know, I honestly could spend quite a long time pointing at flaws in American foreign policy. It has not been perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I think they have tried to move the world onto something that's more based on law and less just about right, might makes right. This is showing us that in a world where America retreats and that nations like China dominate, we're living in a very different world.
That's exactly right. And I think that a lot of these international laws, they have brought a lot of peace and a lot of stability to most people around the globe. But ultimately, if you don't have mechanisms to enforce them, then they're just not worth that much, because nations like China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, they will violate them as often as possible if they feel that that's the best method for furthering their national ambitions. But Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's takeover specifically of the South China Sea really should alarm the world because it shows that China is steering the world toward war. He wrote an article by that title back in 2016, and I'll just read one section of this. It says, China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It is forcing these countries to do what it wants. Everything is headed in the direction of war. This should alarm the world, end quote. And Mr. Fleury stresses in this article that China's takeover of this region is contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about the modern US and Britain being economically besieged eventually by China and some of its partner nations. Deuteronomy 28:52 talks about this future besiegement of the US and Britain and shows that they'll have maritime areas that they once had control over taken over by enemy nations. And Mr. Fleury says that China's takeover of the South China Sea is one of several places where we can already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment. So this is very significant because it is heading toward a time when China and its allies will control probably all of the shipping lanes through this tremendously important maritime region, and America will be blocked out.
Well, thank you for putting that in that important overall perspective. Before we finish up today, you had a few other stories from Asia that you wanted to bring us.
Yeah, first of all, just a quick update on Russia's war to conquer Ukraine. Over the last few days, the Russians have made some significant advances toward the city of Pokrovsk. This is in the Donetsk region of Ukraine, and it is a key logistical hub. So it would be a significant win for Russia if they're able to seize it. And the Russians are directing a great deal of their firepower and strength toward that goal. On Wednesday alone, there were 46 Russian attacks on Ukrainian positions that are trying to defend this area. And as the Russians slowly move incrementally closer in, Ukraine actually ordered a mandatory evacuation of children in this area. The Ukrainians believe that the chances of Russia breaking through are too great, and they don't want to see more children kidnapped the way hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian children already have been since this war went full scale 2.5 years ago. So there is a mandatory evacuation now of children along with their parents or guardians. So this is sobering to see this Russian advance. And it does come as Ukraine is tightening its grip on hundreds of miles of Russian territory, mainly in the Kursk region. So Ukraine is making some gains of its own. But if Russia can continue this advance and conquer Pokrovsk, it would mean a serious setback for Ukraine because this is a key hub for resupply lines especially. So it could have implications really for other parts of the front there in Donetsk as well. And then another quick story here about China severing a pipeline between Finland and Estonia. This happened back in October, and all of the evidence pointed to China from the beginning, pointed to a ship that they have called the New Polar Bear, which had dragged its anchor for a number of miles in an extremely unusual fashion. And this anchor destroyed part of the Baltic Connector pipeline. So all the evidence pointed to China, and China would have had motive to destroy this pipeline as well, since it would increase Europe's reliance on the gas of China's ally, Russia. But China denied it at the time. But a few days ago, China said, okay, you know what? It was us. It was the Nunu polar bear, but it was an accident. And it only happened because of a storm that was happening at the time. Well, Finland replied to this week, saying, first of all, there was no storm. Records clearly show that. And second, you can't lower the anchor of a ship to a very specific depth and drag it for miles at that exact depth accidentally, because the ship's crew would clearly notice the impact on the vessel's maneuverability. So this was no accident, and it was sloppy. And it's just more evidence of China's belligerence, and I think of China's tightening alliance with Russia.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And thank you to all of our panelists today. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. Most of all, thank you to you, the viewer, for sticking it out all the way to the end here, for tuning in. We really appreciate having you with us. You can, all of that different pieces of literature, those different articles that we've mentioned on the show today, we will have links to those in the show notes. I think we've linked to quite a wide variety of different stories today. So if I can just plug one, that relates to, say, what we've talked about more than just about anything else, I would remind you of that book, America Under Attack, that really does expose what is happening in the United States. But that's a global movement as well. That same spirit, so many of those same trends are impacting Britain, Canada, Australia, you know, a whole host of other nations. And then by extension, what is happening in the United States there, that division, that spirit, that is happening all around the world. I mean, just look at the Olympic Games in France's opening ceremony. America's social decline is impacting what is happening in France and Germany and all of these other countries as well. So wherever you live, it is critical to understand what is happening there. And that free book, America Under Attack, will help you do that. If you've got that, if you are interested in some of those other bits, you can see those in our show notes. You can get all of that material at our website, thetrumpet.com. Just go over to our literature tab, or like I said, click the links in the notes. Please do like, subscribe, get notified, leave comments. All of those things really help us get this message out to more and more people. You can get in touch with us at thetrumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you once again for joining us. Please do tune in next week on Wednesday here at Trumpet World. Until then, keep watching your world.